Chapter 4. In the year 1799, a relative of mine came limping down, on foot, to this town of Chatham. I call it this town, because if anybody present knows to a nicety where Rochester ends and Chatham begins, it is more than I do. He was a poor traveler, with not a farthing in his pocket. He sat by the fire in this very room, and he slept one night in a bed that will be occupied tonight by someone here. My relative came down to Chatham to enlist in a cavalry regiment, if a cavalry regiment would have him, if not, to take King George's shilling from any corporal or sergeant who would put a bunch of ribbons in his hat. His object was to get shot, but he thought he might as well ride to death as be at the trouble of walking. My relative's Christian name was Richard, but he was better known as Dick. He dropped his own surname on the road down, and took up that of Doubledick. He was passed as Richard Doubledick, age 22, height 5'10", native place, Exmouth, which he had never been near in his life. There was no cavalry in Chatham when he limped over the bridge here with half a shoe to his moldy feet, so he enlisted into a regiment of the line, and was glad to get drunk and forget all about it. You are to know that this relative of mine had gone wrong and run wild. His heart was in the right place, but it was sealed up. He had been betrothed to a good and beautiful girl, whom he had loved better than she or perhaps even he believed. But in an evil hour he had given her cause to say to him solemnly, "Richard, I will never marry another man. I will live single for your sake." But Mary Marshall's lips, her name was Mary Marshall, "never address another word to you on earth. Go, Richard. Heaven forgive you." This finished him. This brought him down to Chatham. This made him Private Richard Doubledick, with a determination to be shot. There was not a more dissipated and reckless soldier in Chatham Barracks, in the year 1799, than Private Richard Doubledick. He associated with the dregs of every regiment. He was as seldom sober as he could be, and was constantly under punishment. It became clear to the whole barracks that Private Richard Doubledick would very soon be flogged. Now the captain of Richard Doubledick's company was a young gentleman, not above 5 years his senior, whose eyes had an expression in them which affected Private Richard Doubledick in a very remarkable way. They were bright, handsome, dark eyes, what are called laughing eyes generally, and, when serious, rather steady than severe, but they were the only eyes now left in his narrowed world that Private Richard Doubledick could not stand. Unabashed by evil report and punishment, defiant of everything else and everybody else, he had but to know that those eyes looked at him for a moment, and he felt ashamed. He could not so much as salute Captain Taunton in the street like any other officer. He was reproached and confused, troubled by the mere possibility of the captain's looking at him. In his worst moments, he would rather turn back and go any distance out of his way than encounter those two handsome, dark, bright eyes. One day, when Private Richard Doubledick came out of the black hole where he had been passing the last 8 and 40 hours, and in which retreat he spent a good deal of his time, he was ordered to betake himself to Captain Taunton's quarters. In the stale and squalid state of a man just out of the black hole, he had less fancy than ever for being seen by the captain, but he was not so mad yet as to disobey orders, and consequently went up to the terrace overlooking the parade ground, where the officers' quarters were, twisting and breaking in his hands, as he went along, a bit of the straw that had formed the decorative furniture of the black hole. "Come in," cried the captain, when he had knocked with his knuckles at the door. Private Richard Doubledick pulled off his cap, took a stride forward, and felt very conscious that he stood in the light of the dark, bright eyes. There was a silent pause. Private Richard Doubledick had put the straw in his mouth, and was gradually doubling it up into his windpipe and choking himself. "Doubledick," said the captain, "do you know where you are going to?" "To the devil, sir," faltered Doubledick. "Yes," returned the captain, "and very fast. Private Richard Doubledick turned the straw of the black hole in his mouth, and made a miserable salute of acquiescence. "Doubledick," said the captain, "since I entered His Majesty's service, a boy of 17, I have been pained to see many men of promise going that road. But I have never been so pained to see a man make the shameful journey as I have been, ever since you joined the regiment, to see you." Private Richard Doubledick began to find a film stealing over the floor at which he looked, also to find the legs of the captain's breakfast table turning crooked, as if he saw them through water. "I am only a common soldier, sir," said he. "It signifies very little what such a poor brute comes to." "You are a man," returned the captain, with grave indignation, "of education and superior advantages. And if you say that, meaning what you say, you have sunk lower than I had believed. How low that must be, I leave you to consider, knowing what I know of your disgrace, and seeing what I see." "I hope to get shot soon, sir," said Private Richard Doubledick, "and then the regiment and the world together will be rid of me." The legs of the table were becoming very crooked. Doubledick, looking up to steady his vision, met the eyes that had so strong an influence over him. He put his hand before his own eyes, and the breast of his disgraced jacket swelled, as if it would fly asunder. "I would rather," said the young captain, "see this in you, Doubledick, than I would see 5,000 guineas counted out upon this table for a gift to my good mother. Have you a mother?" "I am thankful to say she is dead, sir." "If your praises," returned the captain, "were sounded from mouth to mouth through the whole regiment, through the whole army, through the whole country, you would wish she had lived to say, with pride and joy, 'He is my son.'" "Apostrophe, spare me, sir," said Doubledick. "She would never have heard any good of me. She would never have had any pride and joy in owning herself my mother. Love and compassion she might have had, and would have always had, I know, but not spare me, sir. I am a broken wretch, quite at your mercy." And he turned his face to the wall, and stretched out his imploring hand. "My friend," began the captain. "God bless you, sir," sobbed Private Richard Doubledick. "You are at the crisis of your fate. Hold your course unchanged a little longer, and you know what must happen. I know even better than you can imagine, that, after that has happened, you are lost. No man who could shed those tears could bear those marks." "I fully believe it, sir," in a low, shivering voice said Private Richard Doubledick. "But a man in any station can do his duty," said the young captain, "and, in doing it, can earn his own respect, even if his case should be so very unfortunate, and so very rare, that he can earn no other man's. A common soldier, poor brute though you called him just now, has this advantage in the stormy times we live in, that he always does his duty before a host of sympathizing witnesses. Do you doubt that he may so do it as to be extolled through a whole regiment, through a whole army, through a whole country? Turn while you may yet retrieve the past, and try." "I will. I ask for only one witness, sir," cried Richard, with a bursting heart. "I understand you. I will be a watchful and a faithful one." I have heard from Private Richard Doubledick's own lips that he dropped down upon his knee, kissed that officer's hand, arose, and went out of the light of the dark, bright eyes, an altered man. In that year, 1799, the French were in Egypt, in Italy, in Germany, where not. Napoleon Bonaparte had likewise begun to stir against us in India, and most men could read the signs of the great troubles that were coming on. In the very next year, when we formed an alliance with Austria against him, Captain Taunton's regiment was on service in India, and there was not a finer non-commissioned officer in it, no, nor in the whole line than Corporal Richard Doubledick. In 1801, the Indian army were on the coast of Egypt. Next year was the year of the proclamation of the short peace, and they were recalled. It had then become well known to thousands of men that wherever Captain Taunton, with the dark, bright eyes, led, there, close to him, ever at his side, firm as a rock, true as the sun, and brave as Mars, would be certain to be found, while life beat in their hearts, that famous soldier, Sergeant Richard Doubledick. 1805, besides being the great year of Trafalgar, was a year of hard fighting in India. That year saw such wonders done by a sergeant major, who cut his way single-handed through a solid mass of men, recovered the colors of his regiment, which had been seized from the hand of a poor boy shot through the heart, and rescued his wounded captain, who was down, and in a very jungle of horses' hoofs and sabers, saw such wonders done, I say, by this brave sergeant major, that he was specially made the bearer of the colors he had won. And Ensign Richard Doubledick had risen from the ranks. Sorely cut up in every battle, but always reinforced by the bravest of men, for the fame of following the old colors, shot through and through, which Ensign Richard Doubledick had saved, inspired all breasts. This regiment fought its way through the Peninsular War, up to the investment of Badajoz in 1812. Again and again it had been cheered through the British ranks until the tears had sprung into men's eyes at the mere hearing of the mighty British voice, so exultant in their valor, and there was not a drummer boy, but knew the legend, that wherever the two friends, Major Taunton, with the dark, bright eyes, and Ensign Richard Doubledick, who was devoted to him, were seen to go, there the boldest spirits in the English army became wild to follow. One day, at Badajoz, not in the great storming, but in repelling a hot sally of the besieged upon our men at work in the trenches, who had given way, the two officers found themselves hurrying forward, face to face, against a party of French infantry, who made a stand. There was an officer at their head, encouraging his men, a courageous, handsome, gallant officer of 35, whom Doubledick saw hurriedly, almost momentarily, but saw well. He particularly noticed this officer waving his sword, and rallying his men with an eager and excited cry, when they fired in obedience to his gesture, and Major Taunton dropped. It was over in 10 minutes more, and Doubledick returned to the spot, where he had laid the best friend man ever had on a coat spread upon the wet clay. Major Taunton's uniform was opened at the breast, and on his shirt were three little spots of blood. "Dear Doubledick," said he, "I am dying." "For the love of heaven, no," exclaimed the other, kneeling down beside him, and passing his arm round his neck to raise his head. "Taunton, my preserver, my guardian angel, my witness, dearest, truest, kindest of human beings. Taunton, for God's sake." The bright, dark eyes so very, very dark now, in the pale face smiled upon him, and the hand he had kissed 13 years ago laid itself fondly on his breast. "Write to my mother. You will see home again. Tell her how we became friends. It will comfort her, as it comforts me." He spoke no more, but faintly signed for a moment towards his hair as it fluttered in the wind. The ensign understood him. He smiled again when he saw that, and, gently turning his face over on the supporting arm, as if for rest, died, with his hand upon the breast in which he had revived a soul. No dry eye looked on Ensign Richard Doubledick that melancholy day. He buried his friend on the field, and became a lone, bereaved man. Beyond his duty he appeared to have but two remaining cares in life, one, to preserve the little packet of air he was to give to Taunton's mother, the other, to encounter that French officer who had rallied the men under whose fire Taunton fell. A new legend now began to circulate among our troops, and it was, that when he and the French officer came face to face once more, there would be weeping in France. The war went on and through it went the exact picture of the French officer on the one side, and the bodily reality upon the other until the Battle of Toulouse was fought. In the return sent home appeared these words: "Severely wounded, but not dangerously, Lieutenant Richard Doubledick." At midsummer time, in the year 1814, Lieutenant Richard Doubledick, now a brown soldier, 37 years of age, came home to England invalided. He brought the air with him, near his heart. Many a French officer had he seen since that day, Many a dreadful night, in searching with men and lanterns for his wounded, had he relieved French officers lying disabled, but the mental picture and the reality had never come together. Though he was weak and suffered pain, he lost not an hour in getting down to Frome in Somersetshire, where Taunton's mother lived. In the sweet, compassionate words that naturally present themselves to the mind tonight, he was the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. It was a Sunday evening, and the lady sat at her quiet garden window, reading the Bible, reading to herself, in a trembling voice, that very passage in it, as I have heard him tell. He heard the words, "Young man, I say unto thee, arise." He had to pass the window, and the bright, dark eyes of his debased time seemed to look at him. Her heart told her who he was. She came to the door quickly, and fell upon his neck. "He saved me from ruin, made me a human creature, won me from infamy and shame. Oh, God forever bless him. As he will, he will. He will," the lady answered. "I know he is in heaven." Then she piteously cried, "But oh, my darling boy." Never from the hour when Private Richard Doubledick enlisted at Chatham at the private, corporal, sergeant, sergeant major, ensign, or lieutenant breathed his right name, or the name of Mary Marshall, or a word of the story of his life, into any ear except his reclaimers. That previous scene in his existence was closed. He had firmly resolved that his expiation should be to live unknown, to disturb no more the peace that had long grown over his old offenses, to let it be revealed, when he was dead, that he had striven and suffered, and had never forgotten, and then, if they could forgive him, and believe him well, it would be time enough. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.